Hey everyone, thanks for coming. Bright and early. My name is Sam Danieski. I am the program manager here at Renew Wisconsin. I have been here for a little over a year, or I shouldn't say a little over a year, probably closer to 2 years now at this point. And I manage our solar programs, and I also help out with some of the other sort of educational and outreach type of programs and events that we have at Renew. Before I came to Renew, I was a meteorologist for about a decade, so I like to tell people I went from, you know, talking about the wind and sun in one way to just talking about the wind and sun in another way. So this is Renewable Energy 101. I never thought I'd get a chance to say something like that. I feel like I should have, like, patches on my coat here or something. So there's lots of, a lot of the breakout sessions that we have here at the summit really go into detail, and this talk right here is supposed to, hopefully, if I would do my job correctly, will give you sort of a base foundation to go into some of these other talks. So that's what I'm going to do today, or at least what, like I said, what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to break down the five main types of renewable energy here that we kind of use in Wisconsin. I'm going to talk about some Wisconsin-specific installations. I'm going to go over the history of the energy just a little bit. Don't worry, no dates or anything like that. We're going to go kind of over how they're used in the modern way. What type of energy? Is it fuel? Is it electricity? Is it heating or cooling? We're going to go over, on a very broad level, how it works and, again, how it's used in Wisconsin. So, and then hopefully I'll leave some time at the end for questions, but it's a pretty small group, so if there's something, just raise your hand and we'll hopefully I'll be able to answer it. So we're going to start with bioenergy for a couple reasons. One, it comes first in alphabetical order. And second, because Wisconsin's a very agricultural state. We have a lot of ties to the natural landscape here. So bioenergy is actually a very beneficial form of renewables for our state. Some of the fuels and the products that go into different types of bioenergy are waste products anyways, you know, things like manure, cooking oil, what I like to call kind of the leftovers. So the fuel is not really competing with other types of fuels. So it's really a way to be very efficient with our energy use here in the state. And I'll point out a few more examples later on how using all the different forms of bioenergy is going to be more beneficial. There's going to be more benefits to it than just reducing fossil fuels and just reducing CO2 emissions as well. So, history of bioenergy. Basically as old as humankind itself. I mean, cavemen have been, you know, burning wood for fuel since, you know, basically we could climb down out of the trees. Obviously now, in 2020, the types of bioenergy, and when I say bioenergy, it's really a whole bunch of different energies sort of under one umbrella, if you will. But they've certainly branched out quite a bit in this time. And bioenergy is actually one of the types of different bioenergy is probably one of the few in genres, if you will, that we can use to use both as fuel source, as a heating source, and as electricity source. So we're going to go over that in just a little bit here. So a lot of different types of energy, like I said, can kind of be grouped under this bioenergy umbrella. We can make things like ethanol out of it, used for fuel, things like biodiesel, biogas as well. Wood pellets can be used for heating as well. So lots of different options here. It's a really important energy source for Wisconsin. How it works. So I was saying there's a lot of different types of bioenergies. I'm going to mainly go over how biodigesters work. And the reason for that is Wisconsin obviously has a lot of cows. And we need some way to not only get rid of that manure, but also, you know, like I said, it can have multiple benefits. We can turn it into a fuel source. So this fun little graphic here kind of represents how a biodigester works. It's fairly similar to how a cow's digestive system works, except the fuel source obviously starts out in completely different ways. So in a biodigester, we start out with some sort of manure or other sort of waste product as the fuel source. Microbes then digest that manure, and organic waste, break it down. And the end product we have is a biogas. It's very similar to like a natural gas, and we can use this, like I said, both for fuel for vehicles, buses, other, you know, larger vehicles that, you know, might need some sort of diesel type product, and also obviously for heating as well. And then we could even use it in theory to power a natural gas plant as well. And then there are also other byproducts. You can, some of the things that come out of this process, compost, fertilizer. There's even bedding for cows, which I think is kind of weird. If I was a cow, I wouldn't want to be sleeping on a bed of my own making, but apparently the cows like it. So so we have several different types of bioenergy installations in Wisconsin. Things like farm digesters. I believe we have 30-some farm digesters. We have ethanol plants, wastewater treatment plants as well. I think we have two, maybe more, landfill gas systems as well. In fact, one just over here on the east side of town. And food waste systems, and then also timber waste processing as well. So quite the genre, quite the array of different types of bioenergy that we can use here in the state. Next type of energy I'm going to go on to is geothermal. Obviously, we don't have geysers here in Wisconsin, but we can still tap into other types of geothermal energy. This is actually a very important energy source in Wisconsin as well, because our heat fluctuates quite a bit. So geothermal in our state is mainly used for heating and for cooling, but in other places it can be used for other types of energy as well. In fact, you can even, there are other places, mainly in the western U.S., where there are geothermal plants where it actually will create electricity from that energy. So just to go over this a little bit, also another very old technology. Native Americans basically been using geothermal, you know, mainly hot springs and things like that to do things like cooking and cleaning and bathing as well for centuries and centuries. Like I said, now it's primarily used, at least in Wisconsin, for heating and for cooling. There also are, like I said, installations where there's actually an electrical power plant. Most of those are in the western United States where there's a little bit more geothermal activity. So this is basically how it works. The Earth's internal temperature, is very constant. Has anyone been to the Cave of the Mounds? Anyone? So the Cave of the Mounds is basically it's 50 degrees almost the entire year round, whether it's 20 below outside or whether it's 90 degrees. And so what we do on a kind of a very rudimentary level is we tap into the Earth's constant temperature. So in the winter, let's see here. What we do is we sort of, it's a heat pump, so we just, you know, pump that warmer air into our houses. In the summer, of course, it's the opposite way. You know, 50 degrees is a lot cooler than it would be outside. So it's just basically the reverse process. We kind of try to tap into that constant temperature. You know, the heat pumps are actually a much more efficient way of heating or cooling air than it would be to have an air conditioner on or to have a furnace on or something like that. So it's a very efficient way to tap into this type of renewable energy. And it's a much more efficient way than to, like I said, use electricity or use some other type of energy for heating or cooling. Any questions on that? All right. So like I said, in Wisconsin, we mainly use this for heating and for cooling. There are homes that have it. A lot of times, these installations typically are larger facilities, schools, churches, businesses, factories, things like that. And like I said, there are no geothermal power plants in Wisconsin, but there are quite a bit in the western U.S., and they're actually becoming a little bit more present worldwide as well, especially in some of the Pacific countries around the Pacific Rim where there's a bit more geothermal activity. In order to make a geothermal electricity power plant, you're going to need temperatures anywhere from, I think it's 300 to 700 degrees. So in order to get that in Wisconsin, we have to really tap down into the Earth's crust a little bit more. But, you know, in some of the areas where, you know, like western U.S., where that geothermal activity is a little bit closer to the surface, it's a little bit easier to tap into that energy. Okay. Next, hydropower. I think everyone has probably seen or kind of understand a little bit how hydroelectric dam works. Most people, I don't know, maybe I'm assuming wrong, would not assume that Wisconsin has a lot of this type of energy. States out west again, Washington, Oregon, they have a lot of access to hydroelectric power. In fact, the state of Washington, I think, produces almost a third of the entire U.S.'s hydroelectric power. So one would normally not think that Wisconsin has this type of resource, but we actually do. In fact, it's the largest percentage of renewables in our state. And we also, Wisconsin has a bit of a history to this energy source as well. So this is another type of energy that has some really old origins, but in terms of modern hydroelectric power, it has, like I said, roots to Wisconsin. So the very first power plant of any type, renewables or not, was actually in Wisconsin, up in right on the Fond du Lac River. This is the Vulcan Street Power Plant. It was the very first power plant. It was sort of a... it was made out of a power plant that Thomas Edison had designed. So a local gentleman had taken that design, and he actually made the first power plant. And it powered that building there itself, his house, and then I think a factory nearby as well. So three buildings. So not a lot, but, you know, first is still first, right? So it's pretty interesting. After that, from the 1900s to about the 70s, we had a lot of hydroelectric dams that were built in the U.S. We haven't had quite as many anymore, but it's still a pretty effective source of electricity for us. And this is sort of how a hydroelectric dam works, in case you don't know or haven't really taken the time to look at a cross-section. So this is our reservoir here. As the water comes in, it turns the turbine. As you know, when the turbine turns, it creates electricity. That goes through your transformer and then out onto the grid, basically. So it's a pretty simple setup. And like I said, it's one of the most efficient types of electricity and energy production. It's about 80% efficient, which is way, way more than a coal plant or a natural gas plant or a petroleum plant or something like that. Now, Wisconsin installations. We have quite a few. A lot more than I thought before I first started researching this. So we have 105 hydroelectric dams throughout the state. This map is kind of hard to read, but the little black dots here are those installations. Most of them are along rivers. I believe this is the Chippewa River here, we have the Wisconsin River, and I think that is the Fox River right there. So, you know, quite a few. 546 megawatts worth of electricity can power over 200,000 homes. And like I said, it's the largest percentage of renewables in our state, over 40%, I think about 41%. And it produces 4.1% of our total electricity. So, you know, hydroelectric power, and as far as renewables go, it's gotten a little bit of pushback lately. You know, people want to sort of, they don't want to dam up rivers. They want to, you know, keep rivers in sort of their natural habitat. But it's definitely a source of electricity that we need to utilize going forward. Any questions on that? No? Oh, yeah. I don't think so. I mean, I think the rivers kind of ebb and flow throughout the year. You know, in the springtime, obviously, it goes up quite a bit. In the fall, it goes down. But in terms of on a permanent basis, I don't believe any of these installations are having that issue.
Oh.
For
the thing, and there's been a guy working on it for years to try and restore it.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know specifically, like, installation to installation, like how they're doing. You know, I think the age of some of them are actually kind of getting up there. Some of them may need to be replaced, but we're hoping that they are replaced and not decommissioned. Okay. All right, we're going to move on to solar energy now, kind of getting into the big boys here. Solar energy is kind of becoming almost the default energy source now in our state, which is really, really exciting. We have another, you know, misconception some people have, especially this time of year. Wisconsin doesn't have enough sunlight to power our electricity sources. Couldn't be further from the truth. We actually get quite a good deal of sunlight throughout the year. Germany made a huge investment in solar electricity a few years ago, and all of Germany is much further north than even the northernmost part of Wisconsin is. So if they can do it, we can certainly do it here as well. So I'm going to talk about solar energy, and specifically solar photovoltaic. We're not really going to hit on solar hot water. I know that was kind of popular about 10, 20 years ago, but we're going to mainly talk about PV. And as a side note, this gentleman here is my dad. Full disclosure, this is actually, my parents live in Minnesota, so this is outside of Wisconsin, so don't tell anyone. But this is their array. They just put it in last December, so a little over a year ago, and they could not be more happy with it. I'm trying to get my dad to try to get some kind of electric tractor or something, but we'll work on that. And this is their Christmas tree farm, too, behind there, so just as a side note. I love showing that picture because it really demonstrates, especially, you know, in a Wisconsin winter or Minnesota winter, that, you know, solar panels can still work. So we're going to go over the history a little bit, just very little bit. Basically, modern solar PV is actually pretty old. The photovoltaic effect was first discovered back in 1883. The first kind of commercial use was used by Bell Labs in the 50s, and after that, the next kind of big boom up until just recently was in the 70s during the oil crisis and during the space race. You know, you can't exactly send a rocket ship into space with a whole bunch of petroleum to fuel, you know, rovers and things like that, so they need to be powered by solar. Back in the 50s, when Bell Labs was first designing their solar panels, they used selenium, not silicon, and the cost was about $300 per watt. Now it's down to about 40 cents per watt. So huge, huge difference there, obviously. Part of that reason for that is silicon is just a lot more prevalent. It's like the second most common mineral on the planet. So that and just the fact that countries like China and other countries have just produced so much more solar panels, it's driven down the price. So we're going to go into a little bit now of actually how it works. This is the most sort of simple illustration that I could find showing this. So how a solar panel works is we have two layers of silicon. And what happens is manufacturers pump in areas with more electrons. That is this n-type right here. And then they take some electrons out of this area. And what happens is when the sun heats up this part of the silicon panel, it excites those electrons. And then they go and basically just flow down the tube. I'm sure there's a better way to explain that, but that's how I'm going to put it to you on this level. So it's pretty simple. It's a chemical reaction. There's no moving parts to break down. There's nothing to fix, which is why solar has become kind of the default measure. There's really no upkeep on it whatsoever. This is sort of how a basic solar installation works. So you have your sun hitting the panels right here. This illustration is moving a little faster than I would have liked. And what happens is creates what we call DC electricity. That DC electricity flows to an inverter right here, which converts it to AC, alternating current, which is what most of our lights and our TVs and our phones and things like that are powered on. So then it powers your home up here. We also now are starting to see more battery installations on residential solar arrays. They're not very common. They're still kind of expensive, but we expect, you know, in the next 10, 15 years or so, that battery price is going to try to take the same nosedive as what solar has done in the last 10 or 15 years. So what happens with a grid-tied solar array, and this is how probably 99% of both residential and commercial solar arrays are, how they're created right now, what you have is when the sun is producing electricity, it powers your home. When the sun is not out, or on a cloudy day at nighttime, energy still comes in off the grid. You're able to use your home or your business just as normally as you would any other time. And then, oftentimes, especially for residential installations during the week when people are away at work, when you're actually producing more electricity than you're using, that energy goes back out onto the grid. Most, I believe, all of the utilities in Wisconsin have some sort of what we call net metering. So what happens is when your electricity goes through your meter, it'll actually kind of dial backwards. And then at night, on cloudy days, it'll go forward again when you draw energy off the grid. So that's kind of how a grid-tied solar array works, which again is probably about 99% of solar arrays installed in the state right now. Again, batteries are becoming more prevalent in the, you know, about 2 years that I've been with Renew, they've gone from almost laughable to quite a few of our solar installers have now put some in. Any questions on how a grid array works? No? Okay. We also have utility-scale solar in the state as well. It kind of works on the same level to some degree. We have the sun, you know, creating energy here with our solar panels. You have a big inverter box where that electricity is converted again into AC. It goes out onto the grid, and then it gets dispersed to homes and businesses. Pretty straightforward. You know, the basic components are still there. It's just on a much, much larger scale. And Wisconsin installation. So like I said, solar is really great, not only just because the price has come down so much, but also because solar is really scalable. You know, you can have small little home installations like this, or you can have big, big solar farms. This map right here is a map of the solar farms that are coming to the state. I don't believe any of these, maybe with this exception here, in Richland County. Very few of these are built, but a lot is coming, and I'm going to show you a little bit more on that in just a second. So now we're going to move on to wind energy. How am I doing for time here? Okay, pretty good. Wind energy also has pretty good potential in our state, maybe not as much as you can probably guess in neighboring states like Iowa and Minnesota and Illinois, but we do have the potential. It is there, but we are a little bit behind our neighbors as well, so hopefully we can remedy that here in the next few years. History, again, another very old technology. These are sort of the old predecessor to our modern wind turbines. Humans have been using windmills for quite a while to do things like pump water. This Halliday windmill is actually this one right here, which is kind of the iconic windmill that I think a lot of people think about, either that one or these Dutch windmills here. The first electric turbines started coming online in the late 19th century into the early 20th century. There was a few installations that were done kind of in the early aughts and into the 30s. There was a few actually that got made during the World War II era. And then we had really very little activity for almost 100 years until, again, the 70s and the 80s when we had the oil crisis and a little bit more of an environmental focus. And then in the 80s, the first wind farms came online, and it's been kind of gangbusters since then. So this is how wind energy works. A wind turbine is actually a little bit more like a airplane than like a fan. So what happens is the fans are actually kind of molded in a curve, and when the air flows over it, it creates a small area of low pressure, and that's what actually turns the blades of the turbine. So what happens is, like I said, the wind turns those turbine blades. That turns this gearbox right here, which then in turn turns this generator. This large gearbox here is, like I said, it's much larger than the small one. And what it can do is, when this shaft turns, it actually turns this one at 100 times the RPMs. So it really generates quite a lot of electricity in quite a short amount of time. So really cool there. And then the electricity from that generator flows down the shaft, and then it goes down out into the grid. Where are we at here? So turbines have been getting much, much more taller. This has partly allowed them to become so efficient, and also how wind energy has been able to become so affordable and cheap. It's actually cheaper now to build a new wind farm than it is to run an existing coal plant. And part of that is because of the technology of the turbine blades, the materials that go into it, the heights as well. The Saratoga Wind Farm, which is owned by MG&E in Iowa, has blades basically about as tall as the tallest current onshore U.S. turbines. They're about 499, about 500 feet. And then the blades themselves here are over 90 meters. They're basically about two-thirds of the height of the towers themselves. So the technology has really increased quite a bit just over the last few years. On the left here, we have a map showing, this is wind speed at, I think it is 100 meters. So right around where these taller turbines would be. So as you can probably guess, you know, the Central Plains have quite a bit more of a wind energy resource than we have. Wisconsin doesn't have quite as much. This is about, let's see here, it's about 7 meters per second. So it's about 15 miles per hour, which is actually right where we need to be for wind energy production. Turbine blades start making electricity at about 6 to 9 miles per hour. They actually max out at about 30 miles per hour, 25 to 30 miles per hour, depending on the model of the wind turbine. And after that, you don't make any more electricity when the winds are blowing at 40 miles an hour than when they're blowing at 30. And when they get up to about 55, 60, then you have to actually shut them down, because otherwise they break, and it's really not a good situation. Each turbine, not only in addition to getting taller, is also getting larger in terms of its wattage size. So a lot of the onshore U.S. turbines now are anywhere from 2 to 3 megawatts each. This new one here that General Electric is making, this offshore wind turbine, is going to be about 12 megawatts just for one turbine. So pretty impressive. Any questions on that? Yeah. So there's kind of a curve. So six to eight miles per hour is when they start making electricity. And then at about 30 miles per hour, that's when they're making their max amount of electricity. And so, like I said, between 30 and 50 or 30 and 60, wherever they shut down at, you're not making any more electricity in between there. Yes? So this map, unlike our solar map, is a map of actual active wind farms in Wisconsin. We don't have, like I said, nearly as many as our neighboring states like Iowa and Minnesota, but there is the potential, and there's also more wind projects coming in the pipeline as well. I wanted to touch on battery storage here for just a minute. We have a lot of renewables in our mix. We need them all, and we also are going to need battery backup as well. To help out with sort of the ebbs and flows of solar and wind. We all know the arguments that, the sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time, and it's very true. So that's why we need battery storage backups. So this is sort of the materials right now that most of the larger battery packs are using. Lithium ion batteries are kind of the ones that you have in your phone, but we also have other materials as well that go into that battery production. Most of these materials can be reused and recycled as well, but of course there is some pushback with how we get those minerals and materials out of the ground as well. Most of the batteries, of course, that we have now are actually going into electric vehicles, but we have more and more going into homes and other buildings, and also used for grid storage as well. So just wanted to touch on batteries real quick. To be fair, I don't know a lot about batteries. It sounds like you have to be basically like an engineer in order to really be able to describe that technology very well, because it's moving so fast, much faster than solar or wind or some of the other technologies that we talk about. So this is sort of what is on the horizon. So this is our map of large, just solar and wind, installations in the MISO queue. MISO stands for the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. It's sort of our regional grid here in the Midwest. So right now, for solar, we have about 130 megawatts online today. Over 5,000 megawatts are coming online here in the next few years. We have 737 megawatts of wind power currently in the state, and we're going to be bringing online another 1,196 megawatts in the coming years as well. And then we have a little bit of battery storage in the queue as well. I don't know, every project on this list has different timelines, so I can't say, you know, all these projects will be done in 2 years or 5 years or whatever. But this is sort of what's coming. This is sort of our let's be optimistic slide right here. So when all this gets put in, we'll have about 33% of our energy mix will come from renewables. Right now, I believe in Wisconsin, we're at about 10. So something to be hopeful for. Yeah?
So why are the electric companies still insisting on beefing up their coal places?
I'd have to know specifically which utilities you're talking about, because most of the ones that I deal with are actually, they want more renewables to come online, mainly because of the cost now. Like I said, you know, it's cheaper to build an existing wind farm than it is to run a coal plant. But every utility has their own interests, so I'm not quite sure how to answer that.
What would those interests be that way?
The financial. Again, it depends on which utility you're talking about, too. Most of the utilities that I've worked with are actually very, very interested in renewables. They really do want more renewables to come online. But there's a lot of other factors that go into it, too, which actually probably pertain more to the grid talk over there than they do to this talk, actually.
Okay. So is that 30%, is that our maximum capacity? Could we
Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely, yeah. We could. These are actual projects that have been proposed.
Okay. And what's holding us back? How does the PSC fit into that?
Well, we'll probably go into that more during the policy discussion, which is coming up at 9:30.
Okay.
But, yeah, every project above... I think it's 100 megawatts has to be approved by the PSC. So these smaller ones do not have to, like this project, where is it here? This map is a little out of date. This project here, the solar project in Richland County, has actually come online already. This did not have to go through PSC approval. These larger ones here, you've probably heard about Badger Hollow. This is the 300 megawatt one right here. That one did have to go through PSC to get approved.
Is that off the grid?
Nope. I don't know which utility is buying that electricity, but it is online. It is commissioned. It is producing electricity. Nope. It's I don't know at what stage, like in the ownership process, it's at. Usually, how these projects work is they're built by a developer, and then the developer either owns it and sells the electricity, or most oftentimes they just sell it to one of the utilities, and then they use it as they need.
Could individuals, if the developer could have had it for sale, could a group of individuals buy it? and church.
You then would become a public utility, and there are lots of rules and regulations around that. So, no. This is kind of the short answer to say that.
Okay.
In fact, you can't even have like a solar array on your home that's much bigger than it would be. I mean, you can, but the economics, I guess, aren't really on your side. You don't want to be overproducing more than you need, because you have to sell that electricity at a wholesale price, and then when you buy it back, you have to buy it back at a retail price. Yeah?
My question's a little twofold, but Okay. Basically what I'm asking is, greater utility organizations or interests that have financial motivations to be vested for hedging their bets in oil and gas or otherwise fossil fuel-based power, are they due for kind of a day of reckoning, given the current political climate and our interests in the Middle East that are supplying most of those needs? And two, is it wiser then to shift their interest into hedging their bets into a portfolio of renewable energy? And how then, if we're in this industry, do we communicate that it's actually wiser to go with more renewable energy options if the historical data isn't there to support the economics yet?
There's a lot there. No, it's okay. I think just the way that the free market is taking this, I think the writing is on the wall for a lot of utilities. They realize they are going to have to invest in renewable energy sources. I might have a slide here, actually, that shows, a lot of the utilities have voluntary commitments to this. Ultimately, they're going to have to answer to shareholders, and if shareholders get enough pressure from their own customers to go renewable, that's what they're going to do. And I think they're kind of already seeing that now. MG&E has a goal of, I think it's 100% carbon-free energy by 2050. Alliant has proposed to build just an obscene amount of solar. So I think at this point, I'm going to use an example of myself. I have, don't tell anyone, I have a Subaru, okay? It's a gas-powered car, and I love it because it gets through the snow, and it, has enough room for all of my family's stuff. I just paid it off last year, so right now, I'm going to use that car. If I didn't have a car today, and I was presented with a Subaru and a Tesla, and if they're about the same amount of price, basically, I would certainly get that. But just like us, normal people, the utilities have certain investments that they want to recoup all of that money from before they go into other types of energy. And I'm very aware of the fact that that seems unfair if you start talking about, things like climate change and pollution and that, but that's just kind of how we're at. But the thing is, if we can continue to reduce the price of solar and wind, that decision for them is just going to be a lot easier to make if it's strictly from an economic perspective. I hope that answered your question. Any other questions? Oh, yeah, sorry, I didn't see you.
Can you speak at all to the grid support functions of
some of the renewable resources? I can try. Is there like a more specific... what exactly were you?
Kind of energy storage, pretty briefly, So
battery storage, just like solar, is pretty scalable, right? You can have a tiny little battery, lithium-ion battery for your phone. You can have really large. I'm trying to think. I think this proposed battery storage project here would be the largest in Wisconsin. It's done on a variety of different scales. It's usually the idea is that it will overproduce in solar and wind when those resources are available, and we'll store it four times for off-peak hours, right, when those resources aren't available. Thankfully, peak demand is during the day and kind of into the evening hours, and that's when wind and solar work at their best. So, if we continue to bring these projects online, hopefully we won't need as much battery storage, but I do think that it's a pretty essential component, which is why I was in the talk here, even though battery storage is not a renewable energy generation type. I think it's really important to talk about, and it's really going to be important as we continue to bring more wind and solar online. Yeah? I believe the PSC, if you go to the Public Service Commission, I think there is a tab on their website where you can see, you know, it gets pretty legalese speak at that point. But yeah, you can go and look up what projects those are, what projects are, you know, some of them might not even be at that stage yet. This is a little different from the PSC. This is the MISO queue. Which again is sort of the regional grid. So that is more, the reason this is in that queue is because that is more of like a physical planning stage that they have to figure out, whereas the PSC, it's more of like a policy kind of legal issue. Yeah?
Very broad question. In general, it seems that
I suppose it always depends on who you ask, right? I mean, we would certainly argue that for society as a whole, you know, renewables are much better. You know, whether you're talking about climate change, whether you're talking about pollution, healthcare, hopefully equity as well, you know, racial and social equity. Solar, wind, renewables in general have a much more way of leveling the playing field. A lot of those, let me go back to that slide, you know, these installations right here, everything sort of in this area of the state, it's pretty rural, right? The developers have to make lease payments to the landowners due to their farms, right? Need a lot of land for these projects. So as a gentleman, actually, let me go back to this slide here, who's going to speak later on today. Whoops, went the wrong way. One more. In our, where is it? Oh, no, I have the wrong slides in there. it's in an afternoon breakout session. Clearly, I did not copy and paste correctly. Large-scale solar team. He's actually a landowner for the Badger Hollow. He's leasing his land for those solar panels. So the developers have to pay the landowners lease money, essentially rent their land, and then they also have to make tax payments to the county as well. There's a wind farm, Quilt Block Wind Farm, which is down here in Lafayette County. The payments that they make to the county and other tax sources. So it's, you know, it's really a way to revitalize rural portions of our state that, you know, typically when economic hardships happen, they affect them a little bit more. So I hope that is sufficient enough.
When you talk to turbines, when you're talking about the blades getting bigger, and they start at like 6 to 7, then the reason you see bigger blades is greater surface area to get like 4 to 5 miles per hour?
So, you know, the reason, let me go back here. So as a meteorologist, I can tell you that the further up in the atmosphere you go, the more wind you're going to have, like less wind resistance. So ultimately, you want to make your turbines as tall as you can, because even on a day, you know, where at the surface there's really no wind, 500 feet up, there's going to be at least 5 or 6 miles per hour of wind, right? So ideally, if we can build those turbines super tall, we're going to be able to catch even very small amounts of wind much more frequently, right? I don't know how that works in terms of when we're gonna, if we're going to have to shut them off more often, too, as they get taller. But I think the instances of that are much less frequent than instances of not having enough wind at all. So, yeah, so the turbine towers themselves are getting taller. The blades, because of the increases in technology with, you know, material science, you know, they're able to build these larger blades that are lighter, that can turn much more efficiently on even less wind than before. The combination of those two things is what's led to wind energy becoming so cheap. Even though wind turbine, they need a lot more maintenance than a solar array does. I think wind turbine technician is the fastest growing job in the country. Because they do need to be serviced quite a bit, but still very, very cheap. And like I said, you know, one of these turbines, produces more energy than a few acres of solar. So there's pros and cons to both technologies, which is why, you know, we like to say we don't want to go all in on solar or all in on wind. We want to have some solar, we want to have some wind, we want to have some hydro, we want to have some biogas and things like that. So yeah, it's kind of a combination. It's mostly technology, to be honest. Just advances in, like I said, material science and things like that. Any other questions?
Same with your example.
Yes. That's a good question. My dad has I bought him like an industrial-sized leaf blower that he uses. We like to tell people don't mess with the panels, because the last thing you want is to accidentally like scratch one or damage one in some way. So I think he uses that and kind of like a, you know, these ones on top here are actually pretty high up in the air. They're probably like 15 feet in the air. It's like a really long squeegee thing that he uses. But in general, you know, the solar panels are usually like a black or kind of a navy blue, and they're always running a little warm because they have electricity flowing through them, right? So, and then they're always at an angle too. So typically, unless we get like a really heavy snowfall in a really short period of time, it's going to eventually melt off. If we get a really bad snowfall, you might have snow on your panels for a couple of days, but eventually it's gonna come off.
So I think on like utility scale, it's probably more of a challenge for the snow, or is that easy to put on?
I don't think so. They do a lot of the utility scale solar ones now actually track as well, so they're gonna really optimize all of the heating of the sun. But yeah, I mean, you certainly can't have, you can't hire people to go out and clear acres and acres of solar panels, because then your costs would go up quite a bit. Actually, a lot of times the bigger issue with like a solar farm is the grass is growing too high. I visited one at the Organic Valley farm, and they have, there's a neighboring farmer who has a bunch of sheep, and they pay the farmer to have the sheep come in and eat the grass, so they don't even have to pay someone to cut the lawn. Apparently they used to have goats, but goats will eat everything, including wires and other connecting devices too, so the sheep are smart. They only eat the grass. You'll have a little bit of snow in a climate like Wisconsin and Minnesota. You know, that's it's a bit of a concern, but it's not as much as you might think, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Yes?
Hey, Sam, it's 8:20.
Okay.
So we need to wrap up in here and make our way to the meeting.
I'll be around throughout the day if there are any other questions. I'm really sorry that that I didn't get all of the correct breakout sessions on, but there's lots of programs. Please take a look at which breakout sessions you'd like to attend. If you have any questions, again, feel free to ask me. I'd be happy to help you on your way. Thanks for coming, everyone.